Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's going to be up to the next president to either repeal and replace Obamacare or to replace Obamacare. And I intend to do both.
But replace it with what, Governor Romney? My first guest this hour is a conservative policy wonk who has written a serious-minded article with seven principles for replacing the Obama law while still protecting people with pre-existing conditions. Maybe you saw David Brooks praise this article in a recent column. Various things that Mitt Romney says on the campaign trail are also consistent with his main ideas. So let's give a listen. James Capretta is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He was an associate director of the Office of Management and Budget in the George W. Bush administration, where he had responsibility specifically for health care plus Social Security and other things. He is the co-author of the article, How to Replace Obamacare, on nationalaffairs.com. We have a link to his piece on our site. Mr. Capretta, thanks very much for doing this. Welcome to WNYC.
Well, thank you very much. I'm really pleased to be with you this morning.
And we can't, for time purposes, have a meaningful conversation about all 7 points, but I think that central to your piece is the idea that our current system of employer-provided health insurance, which is not taxed as income, is the biggest thing making healthcare so expensive. How central is that to you as a starting point for reform, and why do you think employer-based insurance pushes up costs so much?
Well, I would I agree with you that it's a very, very important factor. That you're right to pull that from my writing and my thinking about this. I would say, just as we can get to this later, but Medicare is also probably the most important factor in terms of the cost problem in American healthcare, and we'll can talk about that later. But the employer part of this has really two problems associated with it. The first is that the tax preference for employer-paid insurance essentially makes it so that buying insurance in any other forum or platform is undesirable because you don't get a tax break, and therefore it's a remnant market generally for people that can't access employer-based health care. And that makes the premiums higher. They tend to be people that are a little bit less unhealthy for a variety of reasons because they're not in the mainstream workforce, or they're self-employed, or some other early retirement, or other reasons why they're not attached to a large employer plan. So that makes it very difficult to have a stable, accessible, affordable, non-employer market for healthcare because we put such a huge tax break associated with the group market through employer plans. The second problem is that the tax preference is open-ended, so that the more the employer spends on insurance on behalf of a worker, the more the tax break is that goes toward that plan. You know, that provides a pretty strong incentive toward the types of insurance plans that are at higher premiums, that they are expansive in terms of their benefits and expansive in terms of the networks that are accessible through them. And the combination of that means, you know, pretty high premiums, all of which are tax preferred but still quite expensive. That then, you know, makes it much more difficult to economize or have incentives to economize at the worker level. Let me throw in a third problem here, which is that when we have so much of the health system driven by employer purchase of plans as well as government purchase of services through Medicare and Medicaid, in a sense we have a very passive consumer population. People are essentially just enrolled into plans without much choice or thinking about it. They get their plan by virtue of where they work. Or because they're seniors, they end up in default in Medicare fee-for-service insurance. And they don't really have much incentive because of the way they're designed to make an overt choice about a high-value, low-cost option.
So let's talk about that, because one of your central pillars of reform is to replace our current defined benefits, as it's known, approach to health insurance with a defined contribution approach. In other words, in lay terms, giving vouchers to individuals so they can go into the marketplace and make cost-conscious decisions about what kind of insurance to buy instead of just falling back on these third-party insurers, the insurance you get at work, the insurance you get through Medicare by default, whatever, where they're not thinking about the costs. That's your point, and that's one of your pillars of reform, correct?
That's absolutely right. I'm not sure I would call them vouchers in all circumstances, but basically the idea is the federal government, through Medicare, through employer plans, and through Medicaid, provides open-ended insurance subsidization today. And instead of doing that, we can still provide very strong incentives for people to have insurance through a subsidy structure, but design it in a way so that on the margin, they have an incentive to go to a low-cost, high-value option. In other words, if you say to someone in an employer plan, the federal government's going to subsidize you up to a $5,000 tax credit instead of, you know, whatever amount of premium is paid by the employer, then if they decide to purchase a more expensive plan, that extra dollar comes out of the worker's pocket. And if they decide to select a less expensive plan, they get to save the money, perhaps put the excess into an HSA to be used later.
Health savings
so
account.
It gives them a strong incentive to then say, okay, you know, here's my budget in a sense. What do I want to do with that to maximize value to me?
So,
and it's in so doing that you start to bring some discipline to the marketplace.
We have these two big problems in healthcare: a lot of uninsured people and the spiraling out of control costs. And President Obama is trying to solve those twin problems in his way. You're laying out some alternatives to try to solve them in a different way. Let me question part of the premise. The part of the premise that says that people aren't cost conscious about healthcare decisions today because they have these third party payers, the insurance companies or Medicare. First of all, employers are increasingly cost conscious because the price of premiums for them is going up so fast for their workers. So they shop among insurers for the best value. My employer does it and has switched carriers several times. Many others do too. Second, employees in almost every workplace are having to pay more of the premium themselves, plus ever higher co-pays and deductibles. So people are thinking more than they ever did under this system, should I really go to the doctor and spend this money? And things like that. So isn't the era of insurance making everything free for people with coverage over?
That's a very good point, actually. I basically agree with what you're saying, that the notion that the employer-based system is totally without cost pressure, that is not true. I agree with you, that's the case. It's really a question of degree. And what's happened, you know, you've had some recent stories in the press saying, hey, there's been this great slowdown in the cost escalation in the health system. And it's quite true that in 09, 010, and 011, the pace of rising costs did slow quite substantially. The president and his team have sort of tried to take credit for it, saying, well, it's because we've sent signals that we're moving toward accountable care and so on and so forth, which I think is really just not true. What's happening is we've had a deep, deep recession, which has put even more pressure on people to be cost conscious, and there's been a lot of people who have declined to use services that perhaps in the past they would have used. So demand has fallen quite substantially along with incomes as the recession has really hammered the economy. But the other factor is what you've referred to. If you go back in time to 2003, 2004, 2005, there has been a slow, longer-term trend toward higher deductibles in the employer-based system, where more and more people are facing high deductible plans, maybe sometimes by choice, along with HSAs. So the number of people in HSAs has gone up from very small single-digit millions to it's about 13% of the workforce now is in HSAs in the employer system.
And again, that's health savings account system preferred by conservatives in general, where people can put away money for, I guess, at taxed advantage rates to put it away for possible future health expenses.
That's correct. Thank you for clarifying that. But it's in combination also with a high deductible insurance plan.
Right.
So they're already always protected annually against any high expense, but they have a big deductible, and they meet that deductible by paying out of their own reserves in their health savings account.
So that's exactly the opposite of one of the things in President Obama's plan, I guess, which is to guarantee that preventive visits to the doctor would be covered 100%. If it's a high deductible plan, then it means that first dollar payment, as soon as you go to the doctor, which I guess includes for regular checkups, is coming out of your pocket with no insurance coverage. And the Democrats would argue that's such a big disincentive to getting that all-important well care, preventive care, that it's a bad idea. How would you respond?
Well, I would say, first of all, I'd say that, you know, people get what they want when they see real value in it, and people don't want to get sick. I mean, the idea that people wouldn't access wellness care in large numbers, I think the evidence for that is very thin. I know they point to certain studies here and there, but there's also studies that point in the other direction. As usual in healthcare, it's a confused situation. But in general, what I would say is, look, if you move toward a situation where people have more resources that they're controlling toward use toward their healthcare, new options would emerge. In fact, they already do emerge, where people prepay, not through an insurance plan, but through the HSA products, to have wellness taken care of, that they have access to a primary care system where they have much more ready access for all their basic needs, including prevention. That could easily be a product that is offered to people with an HSA, and they could access that for a defined, you know, fixed monthly amount, and it would be, you know, my guess is it would be a much more competitive, accessible, patient-centered approach to dealing with these things than having the government try to mandate it through every physician's office.
We'll continue in a minute with James Capretta from the American Enterprise Institute. He used to be an associate director of the Office of Management and Budget in charge of healthcare in the George W. Bush administration. And he's written an article on nationalaffairs.com that's being widely discussed, especially in conservative policy circles, called How to Replace Obamacare. We can take some phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And when we continue, I'll ask James Capretta why he would eliminate the tax break on getting health insurance at work and have it taxed like income. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC, a campaign mantra for Republicans this year is repeal and replace Obamacare, as they call it, but replace it with what? My guest is a conservative policy wonk who has written a serious-minded article with seven principles for replacing the Obama law while still protecting people with pre-existing conditions. He acknowledges that that is a problem that needs to be dealt with, and while still trying to insure many people who are uncovered right now, he acknowledges that that's a problem that needs to be dealt with, but argues that the Obama law would fail in term, but argues that the Obama law would fail in terms of controlling costs, among other things. So one of the things that you suggest, one of your seven pillars of reform, is to end the tax advantage for health benefits that we get from work. And people don't even think of it as a tax benefit. They just know they're getting health insurance at work, like they're getting vacation at work, and that those aren't taxed as income, right? You calculate your income tax based on the dollars that you get from your job. You don't also add to that the value of the health insurance policy or the value of your vacation weeks. But you're saying tax health benefits as income. Is that exactly what you want to happen?
Well, in the article, actually, we try to make a distinction between sort of the large employer plans that are large and stable and where most Americans get their insurance, and the smaller employer plans and people in the individual market that don't have access to any tax subsidy for their health insurance. So initially, and maybe even indefinitely, I would try to bifurcate the marketplace into two. We hint at this in the article. For the larger employer plans, that you'd still retain this tax preference that you just described, which was accurate. I'd prefer, frankly, if we were starting over, not doing it that way. But because so many people are in such plans today, disrupting them becomes a very big obstacle to moving ahead with reform. So I would say for those larger employer plans, we would retain the tax preference for them, but put an upper limit on it, some upper limit so that the plan, you know, the amount of premiums that would enjoy such a tax preference would be up to a certain dollar amount, perhaps $12,000, $13,000 for a family coverage plan. And then above that, it wouldn't be tax-preferred anymore. And that meant that after-tax premiums would be paid for those plans above those dollar amounts. And that would provide some pretty strong incentive, even in those larger employer plans, to economize and get even lower premium products if possible. Now, for the smaller employers that are out there and for individuals who actually aren't in any employer plan at all, I would scrap the tax break for employer-paid premiums and provide instead some kind of a refundable tax credit that those workers could use to buy insurance through their state-regulated insurance system.
The incentive being to get people out of workplace coverage and into the individual market?
Yes, and the reason for that, for this marketplace, is that it's very turbulent. You know, if you want to know why there's so many people who are uninsured, a lot of it has to do with the fact that they're low-wage people, so the premiums relative to their wages are high, but also they're churning through jobs very quickly. They're in different retail or hourly type jobs and so on, and they move from job to job very frequently, and sometimes they go into public assistance for a while and then come out of public assistance back into an employment situation, and so they're churning through lots of different insurance arrangements, none of which are very stable. If we got them into a new system where they were getting a tax credit and could buy insurance through a state-regulated system on their own, whatever their life circumstances are, as they change, that insurance would stay with them, and it would provide a lot more stability, frankly.
It certainly is one of the weaknesses of the current system and one that's not addressed in the Obama plan. If you change employers, then you have to change from one employer's health insurance company to another if they both offer plans and they're both in different plans. You're trying to create more portability with this kind of plan. Let me get your reaction to what Governor Romney has been saying on the campaign trail and see if he's saying something similar to you or something different from you. He says, quote, quote, give a tax break to people who buy insurance individual. Sorry, this is not a quote from Romney. This is a description from the New York Times on June 29th. It says he would give a tax break to people who buy insurance individually on the open market so they would enjoy the same advantage as workers who get insurance as a benefit at work, which is not taxed as income. Aides to Mr. Romney said tax parity would introduce more consumer awareness of the costs of health insurance, and competition among insurers would drive costs down. So I guess, and I've heard Romney say, that they should level out the tax playing field. But I can't figure out when I hear him saying it whether that means he wants to end the tax-free status of benefits you get at work, or whether he wants to give individual buyers a tax break. Is it clear to you?
Yeah. Well, Brian, I think you're listening carefully because he probably doesn't want you to know which he intends. So I think it's what he's saying is not inconsistent with what I've described on your show to this point. But he probably could take that any number of different directions. I think rightly so. You have to understand that President Obama in the 2008 campaign attacked very, very vigorously Senator McCain, who proposed a refundable tax credit option for employer-based health care back in the 2008 campaign, and they ran tens and tens of millions of dollars in negative ads associated with that idea. And so, I think Governor Romney's probably rightly trying to be cautious here and make sure he talks about replace in a way that doesn't leave him overly vulnerable to those kinds of attacks. And ironically, of course, after having attacked Senator McCain for doing that in 2008, President Obama became the first president in history to tax employer-based health care when he instituted the Cadillac tax as part of the health care law.
For policies that cost too much as a way of, also advocated, pushing people into lower-cost plans. Well, we have a lot of callers who would like to give their opinions about what you've been saying or ask you questions. And again, my guest is James Capretta with the American Enterprise Institute. He also worked in the George W. Bush administration on health care in the Office of Management and Budget. And he has an article that's being widely discussed, mostly in conservative health policy circles, called How to Replace Obamacare. And Rachel in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hello, Rachel.
Hi, good morning. I think my comment is about Americans' ability to understand health care and not just the short-term costs and needs, but the catastrophic things that they might need, and being able to understand and anticipate that and choose a plan that will really cover those things. It is expensive, and my worry is that Americans, you know, they want the best. They don't want to have to worry about it later when there's a big problem, but in the short run, they don't want to have to pay for health care that's going to be more expensive based on, you know, what their current situation is. And I wonder what the guest feels about that.
Mr. Capretta, go ahead.
Well, I think the caller is exactly right. There's a certain myopia that's been well documented in lots of economic literature over the years. People's a little bit of short-termism in terms of their thinking and how they go about making decisions. So I would say that it is the certain responsibility of the oversight of the healthcare system. I'm not for the government totally withdrawing and not being involved in providing oversight of the health system at all. And frankly, the government's knee-deep in every aspect of it now. What I'm for is making sure that consumers have the ability to select low-cost, high-value options. And the kind of options I'm really interested in, frankly, are really not that different from what the president is looking for. I'm looking for integrated insurance and delivery systems where, you know, you talk about Intermountain Healthcare in Salt Lake City, Utah, or Geisinger Healthcare in Pennsylvania. These are plans that are actually people pay premiums into, and they're not just sort of hands-off type approaches. They're actually trying to help people stay healthy and think over the long term and not just the short term, because they are in it for the long term. And so the kinds of marketplace I'm envisioning actually would foster even more of that kind of delivery system. That's the kind of delivery system where, you know, people really have a strong incentive to access lots of primary care regularly at low cost to avoid the expensive things that might happen down the road.
And by the way, on primary care and health savings accounts, Trish from New York City writes in on our webpage that the high deductible health care plan that she has does cover all well care for free, that she believes that in New York that's a requirement for HSAs. So that's another way that these can be structured, where the well care is still free, and then there's a high deductible, and then they cover you well if you have a catastrophic illness. Rachel, thank you for your call. And I want to follow up on Rachel's question this way, because you would remove, and I think a lot of Republican politicians who talk about this more aggressively would really want to remove most of the Obama law's requirements for what has to be included in all policies, so that cheaper insurance policies would become available. But why doesn't that mean reducing standards, that people with lower incomes would be tempted to buy crappy insurance policies that seem like a bargain when you buy them because they're cheap, but they risk leaving you with gigantic bills when you actually get sick?
Well, first of all, I think there's lots of issues in your question. You know, the healthcare law actually, ironically, they haven't really specified anything yet that's going to be required in health insurance. You might remember that Secretary Sebelius essentially punted to the states the definition of what is now known as essential health benefits. So we don't know exactly yet, and it's going to be largely a state-by-state decision, what's going to be covered in insurance plans. And there was lots of actually criticism on that from the left when they made that decision, which I thought was quite a politically clever decision on their part. They have instituted preventive benefits, but candidly, most of those benefits are already covered in the vast majority of plans already. What's really at issue is the level of deductibles and cost sharing associated with coverage. That's where most of the dollar amounts are. And, you know, the president's plan, believe it or not, has nodded in the direction of high deductible plans, and made it, you know, maybe even more likely that some people sign up with it, but done it in a regulatory way that I think prevents it from fully taking flight, so to speak, throughout the entire marketplace. So I think there's some cross currents here that kind of cut both ways.
Right.
And the Obama law, you know, I think maybe the premise of your question is slightly off, because they haven't actually specified very clearly what is going to be required in the benefits.
Even
Act.
Though there seems to be so much debate about this in the political sector, like requiring that all well care be covered for free, requiring that contraceptives, of course, that's broken out as its own debate, be included as part of that free well care.
Yes.
And a lot of Republican politicians are saying if you, if you don't require so much to be in every plan, then you can have some plans that are lower cost.
Yes, they are definitely saying that. But I will say that that kind of a benefit is, the reason why that's a controversial issue has nothing to do with the dollar amounts and the premium amounts, which are very, very low.
Hmm.
It has all to do with whether or not the government should be doing such a thing. And the dollar amounts are really associated with, you're never not going to cover physician care. You're never not going to cover hospitalization. Those will be required under any plan, including the plan that I proposed in that article. The question is, or even prescription drug coverage and some of the ancillary services around people's episodes of care, all of those things are generally going to be covered. There's a few controversial things on the margins. But in general, what we're talking about is the level of when does insurance kick in, and what should people be trying to pay for out of their own pockets, out of their own resources, before insurance kicks in.
Mark on the Lower East Side, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Yeah, hi, Brian. I think your guess is accurate in only one point, and that is to get insurance out of the hands of the employer. The health savings issue is a red herring because it's antithetical to the precepts of insurance in general, where you want to increase your pool. By having health savings accounts, all you're going to do is cherry pick the healthy, wealthy people out of that pool. As flawed as Obama's system is, it provides more coverage for more people than we've had in 100 years. And I don't think that your guess speaks really to the real point, and that's for universal coverage, which would lead me to say single payer is the most efficient system that we have going. To say that we don't want government involvement in our health care is also another red herring, because if you look at the Veterans Administration, you look at Medicare, you look at Medicaid, you look at CHIPS, all of those are government-run programs. So what is your guest really talking about except just keeping the insurance companies immobilized at the very top of the profit pyramid?
Mark, thank you. And let's take both parts of that. First of all, how does your plan get the country to near universal care?
Well, haven't talked about pre-existing conditions yet and that issue. What I would say is that the government should institute a policy that says everyone who stays continuously insured would no longer face any pre-existing condition problems. So you could do that, move from insurance plan to insurance plan, including in the individual market. And as long as you've been continuously insured, your health status would not count into the premium you're required to pay.
So that's kind of coercive in the way that the individual mandate is, isn't it?
It's coercive toward insurance regulation. It would require all the states to conform with that kind of an insurance structure.
But it also coerces individuals never to drop insurance if they have pre-existing conditions.
Right. I mean, it's really,
even if
frankly,
their employer,
how the insurance market should work, right?
Uh-huh.
Which is that if you're buying insurance, I think most people would say, if you're paying premiums into insurance and protecting yourself against the high cost of expensive medical care, and then you have to switch plans from an employer to the individual market for any number of different reasons, you shouldn't be facing high premiums based on the fact that you might have mm-hmm. a child with a genetic condition, or you might have had cancer 10 years ago.
Right. So if you have that incentive
question,
to keep
right?
it. If you have that incentive to keep everybody in the insurance marketplace, then you can cover people with pre-existing conditions for not higher rates than other people.
That's correct. Now, you need to do two things to make this really work, though. You need to have a fully funded high-risk pool system so that someone that moves into the individual market from an employer plan and is genuinely a higher risk, they get subsidized out of a public pool called uh-huh. a high-risk pool. And we're not talking about, hundreds of millions of people in this category. We're talking single-digit millions who are going to end up in this, but it still will require some resources to make sure their premiums can remain low and affordable. The other part, though, is that the tax credit we already talked about for the individual and small group market, those would be available to people even if they're not connected to any employer at all. And as soon as, you know, if they don't use that tax credit, though, it goes entirely away. So there would be a strong incentive for them to use that credit
and,
to get some kind of an insurance
and
plan.
And to Mark's other point, which is to promote the single-payer system, like in Canada, obviously you wouldn't like that because it's top-down, government-mandated, centralized, et cetera. But he argues, and a lot of single-payer advocates argue, that you eliminate the middleman that way, especially for people who have government insurance like Medicare or Medicaid. Why let the insurance company sit at the top of the profit chain and take out whatever chunk they take out rather than not come between the patient and the doctor and the payer by having the direct single-payer plan?
Well, I think there's lots of evidence that for those who are advocates of the single-payer plan, I really don't think Canada is a good example for them. I mean, it's true that Canadian health care for primary and preventive care is inexpensive, very accessible. People like it. You can make an appointment. You go the next day. There's no paperwork, et cetera, et cetera. But there's a very, very large amount of evidence that if you're sick, the Canadian system is causing quite a lot of problems. Ask the Canadians themselves. Approximately 1% of all Canadian health care, for those who can afford it and have access to transportation and other things, come across the border in the United States. 1% of all health care in Canada is now being delivered by United States health care system. And that's basically for the very sick, high-end care that they cannot access through the Canadian system.
For those who can afford to jump the line.
For those who can afford it. And so, you know, there's lots of queuing. The quality is much below, in a lot of instances, American health care. I think even people that are advocates of single-payer health care understand that the best example is not Canada. You might point to another country, but don't definitely point to Canada.
Well, we're going to have to leave it here, and certainly we haven't gotten to all seven of your pillars of how to replace Obamacare.
Have me back another time.
I would love to have you back another time. I appreciate, you know, as I said at the beginning, your serious-mindedness. And this may or may not ever become a real debate in Washington. It probably depends whether the Democrats retain the Senate and or Obama retains the White House. But this is what Governor Romney is running on. This is what Republican congressional candidates are running on all over the country. Repeal and replace Obamacare. I saw your article flagged by David Brooks in his column, and then I read it and wanted to follow up and have this discussion. So I really am glad that you came on and did at least part one, and we'll talk healthcare some more in the future, okay?
Thank you, Brian. I really appreciate it.
James Capretta is a visiting fellow at the American Enterprise Institute and a fellow at the Ethics and Public Policy Center. He was an associate director of the Office of Management and Budget in the George W. Bush administration for health care and other things. And his article is on nationalaffairs.com, How to Replace Obamacare. Brian Lehrer and WNYC, coming up next. We will finish up the week with the latest edition of the Brian Lehrer Show's Advice Roulette. So we're opening up the phones right now for you to call in and ask another listener for one piece of advice on anything. And in exchange, you have to give a piece of advice to the next caller on whatever they ask you. It is that simple. Have you played Advice Roulette with us before? Call up and give it a shot if you haven't. Or if you have, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. It's that simple. Think of one thing you need advice on. It can be frivolous, like what to do this summer weekend, what to see, where to go, where to eat. Or it can be serious, like whether you should sign that lease or break up with your boyfriend or girlfriend. It's also Friday the 13th, so maybe you need advice on luck or how to avoid calamity. But it's Advice Roulette. Call up and ask another listener for any one piece of advice, as long as you're willing to give a piece of advice to the next caller. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692.